Rhodes. If it pleases the court, on June 30th, 2015, this court issued a preliminary writ of prohibition. And today, based upon the theories we presented in our briefs and in the arguments we're about to present to the court, that writ should be made permanent. The standard of review for this matter was set forth in the case of State Ex Rel Marinus Province versus Ross. Under the facts less compelling than those presented today, this court held that the writ of prohibition is the appropriate remedy when, in order to avoid irreparable harm caused by unnecessary, inconvenient, and expensive litigation. Those are the circumstances we have here. I would like to address the waiver issue raised by the plaintiff. And I say raised by the plaintiff because it truly cannot be raised by the respondent, because the plaintiff claims that we waived our rights to present the summary judgment and the application for writ on the statute of limitations because somehow we waived them. Yet it is the order of the respondent, Judge McKenzie, under which the answer was filed on January 12, 2012, and was the order of respondent Judge McKenzie that found our statute of limitation defenses to be appropriate in response to plaintiff's motion for more definite. Those are the basis for this writ of application for writ of probation, and it was set forth in the answer both by the Heart of America Council and the Boy Scouts that the cause of action accrued in 1992, yet statute was not, the petition was not filed until 2011. There are two very important facts the court must consider here. This is not a repressed recollection case. The plaintiff has admitted in the petition and in all of the, in his deposition, that he always remembered the incidents of abuse that lasted for 5 years, dating back to 1992. That's one fact. The second fact that has to be remembered that's pivotal here is that in 2001, at age 21, the plaintiff retained a lawyer to look at the facts that are the basis of the petition he filed in 2011 at age 21, 10 years before suit was filed. Those are two critical facts. In count one of plaintiff's petition, it is alleged that the Boy Scouts of America and the Heart of America Council are liable to the plaintiff under RSMO 537046, which is the Childhood Sexual Abuse Statute. That was originally enacted in 1990 and amended in 2004. Neither the 1990 nor the 2004 versions of that statute apply because the relators here are non-perpetrators, did not commit the acts upon which the plaintiff's claim is based. Both versions of the Childhood Sexual Abuse Statute defined childhood sexual abuse the same way. It is an act committed by the defendant against the plaintiff that violated 11 specific statutes, specific criminal statutes. Any reading of those 11 statutes clearly indicates that a violation can only be committed by a human being. The statutory construction that governs our look at statutes here is that we look to the plain language of the statute itself. The United States Court of Appeals for the Eighth Circuit in Walker versus Barrett reviewed this statute. They found that this statute does not apply to non-perpetrators. That was the first court of record looking at R 537046. In that case, they affirmed the dismissal of the school district and its administrators for childhood sexual abuse committed by the perpetrator. On November 10, 2015, our Western District Court of Appeals in Doe versus Radican looked over and reviewed the same issue in light of Walker versus Barrett and found the ruling and the opinion in Walker versus Barrett to be sound. The court found that the reasoning and the application of that statute did not apply to non-perpetrators, in that case, the Kansas City Diocese and Bishop Fitz. The court noted that since 537.046 did not enumerate aiding and abetting, statute 562.041, that could not be the basis of liability under that childhood sexual abuse statute. For all these reasons, 537.046 does not apply, and the court should make the writ permanent. In count two, the plaintiff claims that these defendants are vicariously.
Can you address the constitutional issue under that statute?
The constitutional issue, Judge, under the statute, if Your Honor, do you mean
we the retrospective issue?
The retrospective issue. I'm saving that for rebuttal because I thought he'd bring it up, but I can certainly address it.
Always safer to bring up anything you want to talk about it.
Okay. The retrospective issue, of course, in Doe versus Diocese of Jefferson City, the court said that it could not revive a claim that was barred, and that was in accordance with our Missouri Constitution. That does have some application here because we have the 1990 statute and then the amended statute in 2004 where they did change the statute of limitations period from 5 years past 18 to 10 years past 21. In our position, the plaintiff's claim started. He was barred in 2003 when he turned 23. And therefore, when the new statute was enacted in 2004, it did not bring back life to a barred claim. So it is constitutionally, it does not apply constitutionally. This claim, I would like to go back to count two, the battery claim. The battery claim in count two the plaintiff presents is bound or governed by a statute of limitations found in Chapter 516. It's actually a 2-year statute of limitations. The statute commences to run when the damage is sustained and capable of ascertainment. Because the plaintiff was a minor at the time of the incidents, it does not start to run against him until he turns 21. Keeping in mind that the plaintiff always agrees that he remembered all these acts, that it was not a repressed recollection case, we look to the interpreting these various statute limitations by Powell, which said we look to the reasonable person to see it's an objective standard to see. It doesn't even apply here because the plaintiff says he always remembers. And when you apply Powell and you look at State X Rel Marinus Province, it says if it's not a repressed recollection of the incidents, then it starts to run at the time of the abuse. So it's clearly barred. It started running on his 21st birthday, which was May 1st, 2001, and his claims were barred May 1st, 2006, and suit was not filed until almost 5 years later in 2011. In count three, he sets out negligence theories, which again are governed by Chapter 516. Again, we look to Powell and to Ross, and these are barred because he filed this suit 5 years after his 26th birthday.
Opposing counsel argue that the basis of the battery claim, the negligence claim, is sexual abuse, and therefore all three should be under the longer statutes of limitations set out in the sexual abuse statute.
I remember the footnote, it may be yours, Your Honor, in Powell, that says perhaps 537.046 governs all of them, and I believe the Eighth Circuit looked at that also. And even with that, it doesn't matter here because we are non-perpetrators and the period of time has run.
And is that the statute that had the change in the period of limitations
yes.
from 5 to 10 years?
Yes, Judge, in 2004.
And the 5-year period began to run after the 10-year adoption of the 10-year period was after the 5-year period had run.
Right. The 5-year period ran on his birthday in 2003, the new statute was adopted and took effect, I believe, sometime in August of 2004.
And that's because the statute says that the statute of limitation begins running at 18 rather than 21.
Right. The older statute was 18, the newer statute 21.
But also the statute says it's for childhood sexual abuse, so is that a different claim and with different elements than negligence or battery?
I think the plaintiff thought so, Your Honor, because that's how he denominated his claims. Count one was under the childhood sexual abuse statute. Two was battery. Three was various negligence claims.
Thank you.
I did want to mention briefly, these claims are all barred under 516 or under 537 chapters. But when we look again at counts two and three, the plaintiff is attempting to hold the Boy Scouts and the Heart of America Council vicariously liable for the intentional misconduct of the co-defendant Bradshaw. Missouri courts have consistently held that these theories against the Boy Scouts of America and the Heart of America Council or its councils have been rejected because the entities, my clients, the relators here, do not control the day-to-day actions of the unpaid volunteers at the troop level. That's been the finding of the Eastern District Court of Appeals in Wilson. It's been the finding of the Western District Court of
Appeals. And are those binding here, or don't they have, what if they present different evidence in this case?
Well, the Court of Appeals case in Hobbs is a sexual abuse case, Judge,
yes.
And they found that the facts in our case are more compelling based upon the fact that he always knew and agreed that he always knew 20 years before suit was filed. And I believe that these facts, of all the cases that this court's decided on these various statute of limitations, these are the most compelling facts requiring dismissal.
But the rule regarding not extending the statute of limitation after it is run is not a rule that is limited to sexual abuse cases. That's been the general rule in Missouri jurisprudence for a long time.
I agree with you, Judge. I have to say that my practice is kind of headed me in these cases, types of cases, but I believe that's absolutely correct. It's not specific to this area. I did want to say, I know my time is almost over, that as a matter of law, these cases, there is no vicarious liability here because this court and all of our courts have looked at these and said, as a matter of law, the commission of sexual abuse and misconduct is not within the scope and course of employment, whether it be a psychiatrist, a priest, or a Boy Scout leader. And additionally, it is not in furtherance of the interests of the principal.
Thank we'll you. Hear from you on rebuttal.
Thank you.
May it please the court.
Certainly.
I took this case on behalf of the plaintiff for three reasons. First, the facts are appalling. Second, as a scout and a scout adult leader, I was disappointed in what I learned about the scouts. And third and lastly, the law in Missouri with respect to the childhood sexual abuse statute is immense. I respectfully disagree with this court's ruling in the Doe case discussed by Mr. Noes, and I'm happy to discuss that with the court today. I frankly don't think that the Doe case is even applicable. And as we've briefed, I don't think that this is a proper case for prohibition. There's not a single person in this courtroom who has any idea why Judge McKenzie overruled the two motions for summary judgment. It could be waiver, it could be withdrawal, it could be a sanction for violating repeated court orders and delaying the progression of the case. It could be that Judge
McKenzie... Aren't there multiple cases saying the statute of limitations is an appropriate issue for prohibition so that you don't, because one of its purposes is to prevent you from going through a needless trial?
Sure, I don't disagree with that at all. And assuming that that issue hasn't been waived and it's been demonstrated by relators that that's a potential problem here, then fine. But again, how do we know Judge McKenzie got to that issue? How do we know Judge McKenzie didn't decide, hey, I think they waived all this. I think they withdrew all this. Or I got tired of...
He granted them leave to file their answer.
No. He deemed the answers that had been previously filed, at which point in time we filed a motion for more definite and certain statement, and we moved to strike them all, saying these are all waived, Judge.
And that wasn't granted?
It wasn't granted, but it was denied. The motion to strike was denied without prejudice because that issue wasn't ripe yet, and it wasn't going to be ripe unless they either filed a summary judgment motion or sought an instruction at trial. And so Judge McKenzie very carefully worded his order that denied our motion to strike and granted, in large part, our motion for more definite certain statement.
And then they filed a more definite statement?
Not as to any of the defenses of here.
They filed an amended answer?
They did at that point, yes, Your Honor. Yes, but they're inaccurate in their briefing and how they discuss how that came about. And that's important because we strived from the very get-go after they blew the two deadlines that the Judge McKenzie gave them to file their answers. We did everything we could to preserve this issue because it's a little ironic that they're here saying we blew a deadline, but, you know, they blew theirs too.
Go ahead.
A little ironic is all I'm saying.
Counsel, you talk about a withdrawal. Is that a separate argument from what you've just described? Was there some later thing they did that you characterize as withdrawing these defenses?
Absolutely, Your Honor. The withdrawal argument pertains only to the issues raised in the second summary judgment motion, the issues of control and vicarious liability, and the reason we contend those were withdrawn after Judge McKenzie ordered that the affirmative defenses be made more definite and certain and cautioned if they're not, they could be stricken. They filed their amended answers and then filed a notice of compliance and said, by the way, we're withdrawing these issues from the case. We're withdrawing these affirmative defenses, so we're not going to make them more definite and certain. And every one of those defenses that they withdrew were the defenses they then turned around and tried to assert in their second summary judgment motion. And so that's the basis for our waiver claim, Your Honor.
And, of course, none of those, and we'll be guided by what they said there and what you've argued, but those are only relevant if this court does not agree with the statute of limitations.
Absolutely.
Issues. So I want to make sure you have plenty of time to address that.
Absolutely, and thank you, Your Honor. It's our position that the applicable statute of limitations is the 2004 version of the Childhood Sexual Abuse Statute. Under the clear wording of the statute, this case was timely filed. It was filed before the plaintiff turned 31. The whole issue of when it could have been discovered and what the plaintiff knew and when he knew it really isn't relevant unless the lawsuit wasn't filed before he turned 31. And it's interesting to me that the few cases that have addressed this statute, not one, not here, not in the Western District, not in the Eighth Circuit, have taken the time to look at the public policy behind the statute, which is critically important. This is not your typical statute of limitations. This is a unique statute. It's not designed to shorten the time in which claims can be filed. It's rather intended to lengthen the time.
And the general law is that once a statute of limitation has run, the case cannot be reestablished by adoption of a longer statute of limitation. And that isn't a rule that applies simply to sexual abuse cases. So the effect of what you're asking us to do would change the law and would appear to be contrary to the prohibition in the Constitution for retrospective application of law.
I agree and disagree with you, Your Honor. I agree that if there is a vested right, that there can't be retroactive application. I disagree that there can be a vested right when a statute of limitations expires.
We have had cases that so hold, though, including Doe.
You have, and I don't disagree with that proposition at all. The United States Supreme Court disagrees. To get to that point, we have to assume and agree that statute of limitations are substantive and not procedural. But in every other application, in every other circumstance in Missouri jurisprudence, We say that statutes of limitation are jurisdictional.
But we're not talking about the statute. We're talking about your right to, having bought your piece, the statute is run, and no, you can no longer be sued. So we're talking about the defendant being free of the fear of suit, not procedural statute, which you have to plead, which may bar the right. But once the right is barred, it's barred. It's the right that's barred. It's not simply a procedural issue of not raising it properly.
That is exactly what this court has ruled previously, and I'm suggesting that I respectfully disagree with it, because you have to have a vested right. And I don't agree, with all due respect, that an arbitrary statute of limitation that the legislature can change at its whim creates a vested right. And that's what the United States Supreme Court says.
If the court were to reject your argument to change our law regarding vested right once the statute of limitations has run, what's the statute of limitation? What's the effect of that? Does your argument under the childhood sexual abuse statute and your argument that the new statute, the revised statute applies, depend on our accepting your argument that we should change our law regarding, or you have a vested right once the statute is run?
No, not at all. And as a preliminary matter, y'all have rejected enough of my arguments that I'm used to it. But
it's okay. They've rejected a lot of mine, too.
I understand. But seriously, no, because we still have the waiver issue, we still have the withdrawal issue, and then we have the tolling issues, which we haven't even addressed yet. And given this court's recent opinions, I'm not sure you want to wade back into that, but something we feel very strongly about, that even if this court believes that subsection 3 of the childhood sexual abuse statute promulgated in 2004 is unconstitutional, it really doesn't matter, because in this case, given the conduct of the Boy Scouts, all the statute of limitations are told.
Counsel, you would agree, we can't get to any of that unless what you've alleged in count 1 is childhood sexual abuse as defined in the statute. So could you address how the factual allegations meet that statutory definition, which does say any act committed by the defendant against the plaintiff?
Sure.
Not a defendant, the defendant.
Sure. And it says that in the definitional portion of the statute. And it's our position that the statute has to define the predicate acts that give rise to liability under the statute, and that's what that definitional section does. What the statute doesn't do, and something that the legislature almost always does, is say to whom and against whom the statute can apply. Chapter 538 is a great example. It specifically defines health care providers. It tells us who they are and who can be protected by the provisions of Chapter 538. A statute I had the privilege of litigating years ago in the Western District, the statute of repose, starts off with the same language and says any action arising from whatever, but then in the next paragraph defines who's entitled to the benefit of that protection. And the legislature in the childhood sexual abuse statute didn't do that. And they're asking you to read into it what the legislature didn't put there. Of course, there couldn't be liability for anybody under a childhood sexual abuse statute if the abuse didn't occur. So it's our position that it's just merely definitional, and it's outlining the predicate acts.
Then where is the cause of action if that's just definitions? What are the elements of the cause of action?
It's a great question. And again, this is why I took the case, Your Honor, and that's why we pled the case the way we did. If you'll notice, we pled count 1, childhood sexual abuse, and we pulled from the various statutes that we felt applied. Count 2, the battery, we incorporated all that by reference. And count 3, negligence, we did the same thing, because the legislature hasn't really told us what we need to do.
Well, the statute does say for actions brought under this act, or under this section, so it has to be brought under the act, which is the Childhood Sexual Abuse Act. But if all it contains is definitions, it's still unclear how you could pull it. It doesn't say this replaces common law causes of action or changes. Where do you get the authority to bring a negligence action or a battery action as a child sexual abuse action under the statute, which doesn't list those? It only lists criminal acts.
Again, I don't disagree, and it's why I took the case, Your Honor. When I looked at the status of the case law when John Doe came into our office, I was frankly astonished that anybody could ever make a claim for childhood sexual abuse. And that's why we brought the case. That's why we've pled it how we have. And that's frankly why we're here today. This area of the law is a mess. And honestly, I think it started with the Doe opinion, with all due respect, because Doe's an interesting set of facts. Okay? In Doe, all of the sexual abuse at issue occurred before 1990. So there was no such thing as childhood sexual abuse at that point in time. All the claims had to be brought under the normal common law types of theories, and they were. The plaintiff in the Doe case didn't plead childhood sexual abuse. It was not a cause of action in that case. And so, despite horrible briefing, apparently, according to the two judges who wrote opinions for the court decided that, well, subsection 3 is unconstitutional, but it wasn't even really an issue in the case.
It very much, and I wrote Doe, and it was very much an issue in the case. I mean, there was extensive briefing on the issue of the Constitution, of course, not the Childhood Sexual Abuse Act, but what the meaning is of retrospective laws.
And I agree there was a lot of briefing on it, but the plaintiff, I mean, it sounds to me from reading the opinion like the briefing and the record was a mess. So much so that the dissent said, given the status of this appeal on the record, you know, this court should tread lightly when trying to address the constitutionality of a piece of legislation enacted by the legislature and signed by the governor. And, you know, that's a problem. But when you look at Doe carefully and you analyze it, there was no such thing as childhood sexual abuse when those actions occurred. And so, you know, I think the court is right to the extent it said you can't have a cause of action for childhood sexual abuse, and this can't resurrect claims that had previously expired before this statute existed, which is consistent with what the cases cited by the plaintiff in the Doe case said. So Doe's an interesting opinion, and I think it's high time that the court revisit it.
Very well.
That's all I have. Thank you very much. We would ask the court quash the preliminary writ, dismiss this appeal, and remand the matter for trial.
Thank you.
Counsel, would you address the withdrawing of the affirmative defenses?
Judge, when I cited to the court the March 20th, 2012 order, the March 20th, 2012 order found that our statute of limitations defenses were properly pled, period.
And we proceeded. You did file a withdrawal.
But not as to that, not as to those defenses, Judge. These defenses have been presented from day one. They have been the basis of the defendant's position from day one. It's no surprise to anyone that the respondent actually found that our defenses, as the statute of limitations, were properly pled and appropriately pled.
Not the statute, but didn't you say you withdrew the vicarious liability and so forth?
The question on vicarious liability is interesting because a review of the case of Blumenkamp versus Tower Grove Bank indicates that vicarious liability is not really a defense. It's an element of the plaintiff's case that they have to prove the agency in order to make that defendant liable. So our withdrawing does nothing as it relates to his cause of action and his burden of proof. The plaintiff seems to indicate that the concealment statute tolls the statute of limitations in this case, but keep in mind the facts of this case. The plaintiff did not plead nor testify to any repressed recollection. He remembered all the acts which commenced in 1992. By 1997, the acts that are the basis of his petition were in fact the subject of a Kansas City Police Department investigation and a hotline to the Department of Family Services. And in 2001, at age 21, I know I've mentioned this, I don't want to beat a dead horse, but he consulted with a lawyer in order to bring a claim based upon the same allegations here in 2001. This court's case, Clemmy versus Best, indicates that when you bring your case to a lawyer, regardless, statute of limitations starts then because the lawyer does the investigation for you. I would suggest to the court that the facts presented here are very similar on this concealment point to those in Dole versus O'Connell. The Court of Appeals Eastern District held that there can be no fraudulent concealment or equitable estoppel when the plaintiff knows the facts upon which his cause of action is based. They dismissed that case. In fact, in the plaintiff's response to the statement of facts presented here, it was admitted that no one associated with the Boy Scouts of America or the Heart of America Council did anything to dissuade the plaintiff from filing suit, period. 537046, we've talked about that. It's our position. It does not apply. We are not the perpetrator, and that statute is so limited. Thank you.
Thank you.
And I would ask the court to please make this writ permanent.
Case will be submitted. Thank you, gentlemen.